I wish I could break free, back to where I'm supposed to be. Welcome to the Signal to Noise podcast on ProSound Web, sponsored by Blue Microphones. I'm Keith Clark, editor of ProSound Web and Live Sound International, and I'm joined by my co-host Michael Lawrence, who also serves as technical editor of ProSound Web and Live Sound International.
Hey everybody, thanks for listening. The music you heard on the way in was Break Free by Mike Green. You can hear more from Mike at mikegreen.bandcamp.com.
All righty, we're joined this time by Ethan Weiner, who's interestingly been pursuing a career in audio and music since he was a teenager in the mid-1960s, and since then he's gone on to fulfill that mission and much more. Ethan's the author of the widely read book Audio Expert, now in its second edition, which, by the way, Michael served as the technical editor for, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. He's had a hugely diverse career as an inventor and technology developer over four plus decades. He's also noted as an audio mythbuster and is quite effective at that quest as well, as evidenced by his Audio Myths workshop from the October 2009 AES show, available for viewing on YouTube. By the way, it's at 400,000 plus views and still climbing at this point. I could go on, and I encourage everyone to check out Ethan's full bio at ethanweiner.com, as well as his articles on ProSound Web. But we should get to the business at hand and begin our conversation. Welcome, Ethan, and thanks so much for giving us your time today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Ethan, I'm really glad that we're able to do this because I've been calling Ethan for years now, just harassing him with technical questions. And I think a good place to start is the very first time I ever called Ethan, I had a pretty technical question. And he listened to it and he said, "I understand exactly what you're asking, but I don't know the answer." And I was just completely gobsmacked by that because in my mind, this was just, you know, the guy that had all the answers because I had been reading his book and watching all his videos. And so for him to say, "Oh, I don't know," that taught me something really important, was it's okay to not know. You know, and the people that are innovating in this field and moving this field forward, sort of not knowing something is a prerequisite to moving forward, because you've then got to go and find the answers. And if you're convinced that you've already got the answers, that's never going to happen. So that was a very important lesson for me, Ethan, that you taught me probably by accident, which was it's okay to say, "I don't know."
Right. Well, you know, and related to that is knowing that you don't know, because we see this all the time. I see this all the time in audio forums and Facebook groups. You know, somebody will ask a question and somebody will come up with, you know, a really stupid answer. I mean, it's just completely wrong. And it's probably, you know, common wisdom. You know, they say, "Oh, well, you know, you need this or that." And, you know, in the hi-fi forums, it's, "Oh, you need to upgrade your wires," or "You need an equalizer for your room," or, you know, it's some advice that's just wrong. And when you tell them, "Well, you know, actually, that's not quite right. Here's what's right." And I try to be really detailed and really careful to explain as clearly as I can. And then they come back and they argue with you. So that's the other half of admit you don't know if you don't know and be open to learning something new. I was just 70 2 weeks ago. I turned 70 and I'm still learning stuff. They say that, you know, the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. And boy, that is really true.
Yeah, I was always, you know, I always thought that was really interesting when I'd call you. I think I called you once about something about putting capacitors in the feedback loops of op amps, and you said, "Oh, you know, that's interesting that you ask, because I was just playing around with that the other day." And I was like, "Man, that is so cool, you know, that after all the learning that you've done and all the things you've come up with over the years, that, you know, I think there's a strong temptation to say, "Well, I've done a lot and just kind of I'm going to hang out." But no, you're still trying to learn more and trying to educate yourself, and I use that as a model, and I've noticed that again and again with people in the field that I think are huge innovators, is that they're never satisfied and they want to keep learning stuff. You said to me once about, you know, I think when we were working on your book, there was something in there that I said, "Well, that's not completely right," and you were like, "Okay, and we changed it, and you said, I'd rather be temporarily embarrassed than permanently stupid, which is a really great quote that I actually wrote that inside my audio expert copy, because it's a good credo. Ethan, can you talk about, before we get into the myth-busting and the, you know, let's, before we talk about a lot of these commonly held but wrong audio beliefs, as a underlying foundation of that, if you're saying, well, I can hear a difference, you know, can you talk about why that's not necessarily valid? Why sometimes we can't trust our ears? Why we need other sources of objective information? You know, what is it about human hearing that we have to be suspicious of?
Well, it's not only human hearing, but human hearing in perception. I usually say hearing perception because that's part of it too. Is certainly a frail, fragile, not reliable, and not repeatable. I mean, something will, you know, music will sound good. You know, a song, a mix that you make, it'll sound really great, and the next day it sounds terrible. And it was the same mix. It's, you know, nothing changed. But it's, you know, it's the same with taste, and you know, and you've probably heard the stories about the, you know, the famous wine experts that when they're blindfolded, they can't tell the, you know, the $6 from the, you know, $6,000 wine. I was laughed at one report, I don't know, it was within the last year, where one of the so-called wine experts couldn't even tell white from red. You got that wrong. Yeah, measuring, if assuming you're measuring the right stuff and you know what you're doing, is very reliable and very repeatable. If you do a sweep of your room, or, you know, in your case, a large venue, and you do it three times in a row, you're going to get exactly the same results, assuming, you know, there's nothing in front of the microphone and you didn't move around or something didn't change. But every time you play music, it's going to sound a little different. You'll hear a little more detail, and, you know, the one of my favorite examples is people that recap their console, or they, you know, change the caps in their preamp or something, and they insist that it's clearer, and it's, I suppose it's possible that it is, but, you know, every time you hear something, you hear more detail. It's that little, you know, ping on the cymbal or a little bell-like attack on the guitar. Geez, is that really clearer than it was before? And you really need to do a side-by-side, you know, instant A-B. Or you can measure, and that's, you know, certainly much more reliable.
Well, I think, you know, it's to me, it's obvious. I like to watch movies, and a lot of times I'll watch a movie, and the second time I watch the movie, I'll say, oh, I didn't pick up on that the first time, or I didn't notice that the first time, or I view a scene in a different way. You know, it means something different to me. And that's just so clear and so obvious that we wouldn't even think about it. But I think most people would say, yeah, of course you're going to get something out of it the second time. But a lot of people might still argue that, no, you're going to hear the same song the same way every time, or, you know, me hearing the same thing multiple times. You know, I think for some reason we're a lot less likely to want to attribute the same effect to audio. And it's difficult because we can't see audio.
Well, some of it is arrogance. You know, I don't need no stinking science. I don't need no stupid measuring equipment. I know what I hear, and I make a lot of money, you know, with my ears. And that's true. A lot of times, you know, it carries more weight, and it's more damaging to the public knowledge when a famous mixing engineer who really is good at their job, you know, makes these mistakes and thinks that their ears are infallible, especially when they're, you know, 50, 60 years old and can't hear anything above, you know, 12, 10, 12, 14 kilohertz. And masking also, the masking effect becomes more damaging and stronger as you age. And I think some of it is fear. And some of it is just willful ignorance. I don't need to learn anything new. I don't care what you have to tell me. I know what I know, and I know I'm right. So, you know, it's all of that. It's arrogance. It's laziness. I don't want to learn anything new. It's you know, willful ignorance. And I don't think these people are dumb, you know, but the skill and talent to know how to make a really good sounding mix, and you listen to a track and you say, oh, you know what this needs? This needs a little more boost, a broad boost at 100 hertz. That's a completely different skill from psychoacoustics and electronics and knowing how circuits work and understanding the frailties of hearing. These are really completely different things. And, you know, the expression argument from authority, it's a logical fallacy. And, you know, and I see this also all the time in audio farms. Well, you know, well, Bob Clearmountain says that wires make a difference, and he can tell the difference when he changed his, you know, his power cord. And no offense to Bob, because he may not be one of the power cord people. I forget exactly, but famous engineers like that will make a pronouncement, and people will say, well, if it's good enough for Bob Clearmountain, he must be right, or you know, some other famous recording engineer or mixing engineer.
You know, and there's an aspect there that I think is a completely different case, which is when I really did think I heard a difference. And we've all done this. We've all turned up the EQ on the wrong channel and been like, yep, that's better. And it wasn't the right channel. I've done that. And right. I think anyone that's worked in audio has done that at some point. And I really did convince myself that I heard a change. And I didn't hear a change because I was turning up the wrong channel. So I think a lot of it is beyond the issues that you're talking about. A lot of it is that we are so susceptible to what we think we're hearing that you can really, really swear up and down that you did hear a change when you didn't. And so that's very, very difficult to guard against, even if you're aware of it.
Well, I can say related to that is some of the requirements for doing a proper audio test, a comparison or a blind test. A lot of people don't realize that when you're comparing two things, first, it really is important that you don't know which you're hearing. Something you really need a friend. If it's subtle, I mean, anybody can hear a 10 dB boost at 1 kHz. You know, we're not talking about that. We're talking about, is this converter really clearer sounding than that converter? Or is this, you know, does it make a difference when I change, you know, XLR cable between here and there and, you know, some expensive wire? It's really important that levels be matched within a quarter dB. I think this, the real hard noses say, you got to be within a tenth of a dB. Otherwise, it sounds a little different. We're really all that's changed is louder. And I have a great classic example. To me, it's classic because it happened to me. This was a couple of years ago. I had a tune, and I was putting it onto a CD to send to somebody. So I guess this was probably at least 10 years ago. And I burned it onto a CD, and I put the CD back in after burning and played it, and it really sounded different. It was lacking punch and fullness and clarity. It just didn't sound very good. And the problem was it was like much softer. I think the media player in that computer was set to play, you know, WAV files at one volume, and off the CD drive it was turned down. I don't know why. But it really sounded like, wow, this is much worse. What happened? Why did this WAV file not get burned to a CD correctly? And once I realized what it was and turned the volume up, it sounded exactly like what I had just been listening to before I burned the CD. So and a lot of people don't realize these things that, yes, it really has to be blind if you're comparing subtle things. And yes, it really has to be level matched. And it also helps not to move, especially in an untreated small room, listening room or control room, if you move even a couple of inches, 2 inches, 1 or 2, 3 inches, the response reaching your ears really is different. And you'll think it's different, and it will be different, but it's what came out of the speakers isn't different.
Right. And that's, there's a very cool little bit in your book, Ethan, where you've got a couple of traces from a measurement mic taken within an inch or two of each other, and they're very, very different traces.
So, yeah, they were 4 inches apart, yeah.
Oh, 4 inches apart, right. So, you know, this idea of, you know, well, I tried this cable, and then I got up and I changed the cable, and then I sat back down, and it sounded different. It probably did. I'm sure it did, because this response varies so much, and that's, you know, that scales up to even a large venue. You know, when we're working with PA systems in large rooms, you can move that mic an inch or two and really see it in the measurement. And so I think the mistake we make is assuming that was because we changed a cable or because we changed, you know, something in the audio system, and it may not be that at all. You may have changed nothing and could still hear a difference because you didn't sit down in the same spot. So given that, what can we do to get some objective data? One of the things that you advocate is measurements. You use a freeware program called Room EQ Wizard, and it's actually pretty full-featured for a free program. And so that's, I think, a good thing for someone who's just looking to try to get into this and looking to learn to take measurements and interpret the measurements, which you talk about in your book, you know, that's a good first choice because you're not spending $1,000 on a measurement suite or something like that. So, so can you talk a little bit about maybe Room EQ Wizard and its application? And, you know, I want to make sure that my speakers are sounding good, or, you know, is this treatment in the right spot or something like that? Like, you know, what sorts of things can somebody do with this software?
Right. Well, I will absolutely talk about all of that. I just want to make one. I just wanted to get in one other thing before about the testing and doing a proper comparison that people don't realize. And I always say, when you have your friend switch back and forth between wires or converters or whatever it is you're comparing, tell them that it's okay to play the same thing two or even three times in a row. They call that an AA test. People will think they hear a difference even though it's the same thing twice in a row. So I just wanted to get that in. That's yet one more point. Now, and let me also clarify about Room EQ Wizard. That's a fabulous program. It used to be freeware. It's actually now donationware. And I just mentioned that because the guy who wrote it is obviously a genius. It's a fantastic program. He's always improving it. It's just a fantastic program. But if you like it, he asks, you know, could you give me a little money through PayPal? And that's absolutely something people should do, at least if you're a professional. I mean, if you use it more than a couple times a year, I think he deserves the money. I just wanted to clarify that. The Room EQ Wizard is for measuring changes in sound in the room. So it could actually be used to measure audio equipment. I think there are better software that you could hook up to a sound card and insert into a sound card, a loop. If you want to, if you want to measure the response of a microphone preamp, the Rightmark Audio Analyzer is another, and I think that one is pure freeware. Is another popular program that's constantly being updated. But Room EQ Wizard is fantastic because it lets you assess changes in the room And you can see the response. And a lot of times people will say, well, gee, I want to tune my control room, or I want to treat my control room, and I know I have to measure it first. And my answer is usually, well, actually, you don't really need to measure anything. First of all, you will absolutely hear the difference. I mean, the main reason to measure is to so you can assess the difference and see how much better it got after you added bass traps, and all these 30 dB nulls are now only 10 dB, and a 10 dB null may sound pretty terrible, but 20 dB louder on three different bass frequencies is a huge improvement. Another reason is just as a wake-up call. A lot of people have no idea. They obsess over, well, I bought this DAC because the other one was 1 dB down at 20 kilohertz, and this one's, you know, flat out to 21 kilohertz. And so it's a wake-up call to see how bad your room really is. So that's another important reason to measure. A great feature of Room EQ Wizard is it also shows the arrival time of individual reflections. So if you're treating for reflections on the sidewalls and ceiling of a control room, and you're not, you're getting comb filtering, you're getting, a skewed response comb filter, you can switch to the view that shows you when the original first signal arrives and when the reflections arrive. And you say, oh, well, this came 4 milliseconds later. That would be a distance of about 4 feet, a difference of about 4 feet distance. And you can say, oh, that sidewall there, or, oh, it's probably off my desk, or, gee, I have a low ceiling. That's probably accounts for it. So that's another important use for that. It also shows, a Room EQ Wizard also shows what are called waterfall plots, not just the raw response of one speaker or two speakers or both speakers at the same time, but it also shows the decay times in the room, because all rooms have what are called modes, and that gives not only a peak at that frequency, and it could be a fairly severe peak, but it also extends the time. So if you have a bass player playing a note and it's a short staccato note, pop, 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 like Tower of Power or something, the actual sound of the room could be bah, bah, where it's extended and it's not tight anymore. And that's a big problem. So a waterfall plot in Room EQ Wizard will show that. And I know you're probably going to ask me something else, but let me just make one other great point about Room EQ Wizard. Is I used that to debunk the myth of loudspeaker isolation. That has become a huge product category, and everybody is on the bandwagon. You know, Oralex started it with their mopeds, and now, you know, 6-7 companies sell loudspeaker isolation. And as far as I'm concerned, that entire product category is just nonsense. It's all placebo-based, and when you put your Razer speaker up on these pads that are between 0.5 inch and 10 inches tall, like the isoacoustics, all that's changing is its positional, like we were saying before. You move your head a couple inches and the response changes. And the same thing happens with the speaker. You move the speaker and you're at a different axis. The high frequencies arrive differently. The reflections off your desk have different timing and that changes. And I was able to bust that myth that speaker isolation is an important thing that everybody needs to improve clarity by measuring the room using Room EQ Wizard. And I carefully compensated for the speaker heights. That article is also on my web.
Yes, and I think we did post it on our Soundbites thread, Keith, as well. So so anyone that wants to see that, and we can put a link to it on the podcast page, actually, can't we?
Yep, absolutely.
And I will, Ethan, I will say that I actually used Room EQ Wizard yesterday. I was working in a very reverberant concert hall, about 700 seats, and reverb time, you know, RT60 over 2 seconds in the lows, which is a little bit more than you want when you have amplified sound happening. And the venue had variable acoustics. It's an older room, so it's just these big heavy drapes that you pull. And there was a bit of a disagreement between the technical people and the orchestra people about how much of a difference it actually did make. And you know, you can sit around and have conjecture all day, but I said, well, we can get some numbers here. And so I actually did. You know, we set up a little rig and we took measurements, and then we pulled all the drapes and took another measurement. And so we are all able to come together and say, look, this is exactly what's happening when we pull these drapes. And now that we know that, we can go on and make, you know, whatever decisions we need to make for what's going to be best for the event. So it does absolutely have applications outside of a small control room or a small home theater. I know it's, you know, it's generally the home theater, home audio audience, but you know, I do use it for large scale stuff, you know, once in a while. It does really serve a purpose, and that's, you know, that's the best tool for that particular test that I'm aware of. You know, there's certainly other ways to do that, but Room EQ Wizard was there and it was easy and it was great. So even if people that don't work in recording or don't work in broadcast, I still think it's a program that's worth checking out and worth having when you need it.
Right, and it's also proof. You know, as you're saying, you know, people can argue about, well, I think this happened, I think that happened. Well, when you measure, you have hard proof. And it's another one of my sayings is empirical evidence trumps theory every time, because people will theorize, well, this could be happening, that could be happening. Well, when you measure it, you actually know what happened. And you can see, and in the case of drapes, you know, they may get down to 500 hertz, maybe even 300, but that's not going to really do much for decay times at low frequencies, either in a large venue or in somebody's, you know, home theater or listening room or you know, professional control room. And you can see that. You can see exactly what the drapes do. And you can, if you get heavy drapes, that helps. If you pull them away from the wall so they're 6 inches out from the wall instead of right up against the wall, all of that helps extend their absorption to lower frequencies. But it's also proof that drapes are not acoustic treatment or moving blankets. That's another one that you see people say, oh, I got to treat my room, I don't have much money. And right away somebody says, you know, moving blankets. Well, if you don't have much money, you can just buy, you know, cheap attic insulation, you know, and literally, you know, with paper and just stick it on your wall with masking tape. And that will do much, much, much more than moving blankets. And it'd be cheaper too. It'd look like hell, but you know.
So Ethan, you've been, I've been copied in CC'd on an email chain for a couple, almost a year now, I would say, of your project that you've been working on and just recently got to the finishing stages of, called the Null Tester. So can you tell us a little bit about this project and why it's so important?
Yes, and I've been on this for about 2 years. I had a couple of false starts. The first version of the Null Tester was this very big, very complicated box that tried to do way too much. and it just couldn't be manufactured efficiently. I thought this was going to be the be all end all, you know, compete with the $20,000 testers and sell it for like $2,000, but it cost about $3,000 to make. So I realized, actually my friend Julia Truchess said, you know, why don't you just strip this down to what you really need? So I now have a working device, and I've made a video that demonstrates and explains everything that it does and why it proves what it attempts to prove, which I'll get to in a second, and explains how it works. And I'm in the process now of editing the video, so I'll have that done in another week or two, and I expect to generate a lot of dialogue, shall we say, in the audio forums and Facebook groups and online. At this point, the null tester is all it does is it compares two devices. At this point, it's comparing is wire, audio wire, signal wires. It can compare RCA, XLR, and quarter inch, because those are the connectors I put on it. And that may not seem like much, but as we were saying before, there's so much belief in wires that wires make a difference, and it's worth paying money. One of the fellows who used to be a believer and now came to his senses in a hi-fi group sent me a couple of wires that cost $1,000, and he says he realizes now that, you know, that was a waste of money. So one of my comparisons is his $1,000 wire against a $3 wire I bought from Radio Shack like 20 years ago. I have a bunch of wires. You know, when you buy a CD player, it comes with, you know, a pair of cheap RCA, you know, stereo wires. So I compared a bunch of those. I compared some XLRs. So I believe this can be adapted to measure preamps and – well, not measure, and I'll explain the difference, but compare preamps. And by compare, you can compare the input and the output of a preamp. So you're sort of measuring it. You're not actually comparing two preamps. In the case of wires, I'm comparing two wires. But let me just explain a little about why I did this. Besides wanting to bust the myth for once and for all that expensive wires sold to the audiophile and pro audio community are just a complete waste of time and just pure snake oil. That was my motive. But the problem is these anti-science people we were talking about before, I don't need no stupid measurements, and they're lazy, they don't want to learn, or they just think their ears are better than a $10,000 test setup from Audio Precision. They don't believe in measuring. You can't convince them that, well, you can measure capacitance, inductance, resistance of wire. These are the three properties of a wire. A wire could add distortion if it's badly soldered. I mean, if you have a really bad solder connection, or if they're crimped and the crimp is old and there's oxidization, you can actually, a connection, a bad solder joint or bad crimp can turn into a diode. So that could add some distortion. But other than that, assuming a properly connected wire soldered, all it has, those are the three properties, is capacitance, inductance, resistance. This has been known for a century or more. And there's also something called skin effect, but that just affects the resistance. So, but these people will argue and they'll say, well, how do you know what you don't know what you don't know? How do you know there isn't some other property? Well, if you took a basic course in, you know, basic electricity 101, you would know that this is all there is. But okay, I'll go with that. So what we do instead, in the null tester, what the circuit does is it sends the same signal down two wires and then sums them together with the polarity of one reversed inside the null tester. So it sends one signal down two wires, and I compared a 3-foot wire to a 12-foot wire, and you can compare wires of the same length, different prices, and it reverses the polarity. I'm using absolute highest quality, state-of-the-art components. The op amps I'm using in the input stage, because you don't want to, you know, corrupt the process of when you go through a circuit that inverts in order to get this cancellation. You don't want to corrupt the process. The op amps I'm using are the latest and greatest from Texas Instruments. The distortion is 0.00015% distortion, and the noise is, like, you know, right up against the theoretical limit of what you can get of what's called thermal noise or Johnson noise. So its results are absolute. There's nothing is being measured. I'm simply subtracting one wire from the other. It's like A minus A equals zero. And if one of those A's is not A, then you're going to get a non-zero result. But if you get zero, if you get total silence, or in this case, the null, the residual, the signal that's left over after subtracting is literally down in the noise. It's I'm a little better than minus 110 dB. That's not the theoretical maximum, but that's what I'm getting right now with this version of the null tester. But nobody could hear that. I mean, if one signal difference, the difference is 0.0001 dB. So nobody's going to hear that. So this is a way to prove that two wires pass audio the same. And that's what this video I've made using my device, the null tester, that's what it does. That's what it shows. And you'd have to be really ignorant to try to refute that this is what's being proved. Some wires, and this is more hi-fi stuff than a pro audio, but I see these RCA wires where they have a directional arrow saying, oh, yes, it should go, you know, from your CD player into your receiver in this direction, which, of course, is preposterous. If you know anything about audio, audio is AC, so the electricity goes both ways, constantly changing, and the idea of a directional arrow. And of course, when I reversed the wire, I got the exact same result. So that myth is also busted. So, you know, I know I'm kind of letting the cat out of the bag here early, but this video proves what I'm saying. And I explain, I go to great detail to show how this works and why this is hard proof that this $3 wire is exactly the same as this $1,000 wire.
So I looked at an early version of your documentation for this null tester, and you know, I did a little bit of research into the concept of a null test, and what I found is Peter Baxendall wrote about it in 1977, I think it was the November issue of Wireless World, and he had a test rig set up that would compare an input signal and then run that input signal through a power amplifier and compare what came out of the amplifier, you know, and then do the attenuation and null it against the input signal. And so the idea is, like you said, anything that's left over is different. So that would be distortion added by the amplifier or you know, so any kind of nonlinearity added by the power amplifier. And so he had a pretty elegant setup that he used to do that. And you've got what's more or less a version of the same idea. I think yours is probably not directly based on Baxendall's, but more independently developed. But it's the same concept of, hey, we're going to subtract these two things, and whatever's left is the difference. And so saying there's no audible difference, I think, is really the key, because you're, as you said, sidestepping this whole, well, what if there's a parameter we're not measuring? Well, this is a really elegant way of saying, well, you can, you know, have any parameters you want. You know, it doesn't matter what parameters we define. This will definitively reveal whether or not there is any audible difference whatsoever between these two devices. And so I think in theory it's so elegant. What was interesting to me is watching you develop this with your engineering team that you had, you know, how sensitive this thing was to I think in your manual it's 5/1000ths of a degree of phase shift is enough to wreck the null and limit the null to negative 80 dB. And so, you know, that the care and engineering that went into this thing to really make sure we are getting the cleanest null we can, and we have the most transparent signal chains we can have. That was really interesting to me, because it's such a simple idea in theory that, you know, the amount of engineering and revisions that went into making it actually work, I think, was really cool to watch.
Right. Well, and the version I have now is actually my third, because when we ran into problems with the first one, Julia said, well, why don't you just strip this down to the most basic? So that was the second version. Then we figured out what the problem was with the first one. And that's when I had the idea, well, geez, let's just keep this as a simple thing. So then I made the third and current one. And there will be probably one other iteration. And this is actually something kind of not related to the technology, but I don't know how many people would be interested in buying this. If I could do a run of at least 50, it would be worth manufacturing, but I don't know how many people care about comparing wires. So the next step is to look into comparing audio devices. Now, I never claimed to invent the idea of nulling. I don't remember where I first heard of it, but I've been doing this for years. It's real easy with digital, and I also show this in the demo video that I'll have ready in a couple of weeks. And I've been doing it. I used it in my audio myths workshop, a video that Keith mentioned at the beginning that you'll link in the description for this podcast. And it's really powerful. And digital, it's easy. You can null down to minus, you know, hundreds of dB. If you have identical files or identical, you know, 32-bit or greater signals. But nulling has been around even before Baxendall. the earliest Hewlett-Packard distortion analyzers worked sort of on nulling. What they would do is they would send 1 kilohertz through a device, and they would make a really pure 1 kilohertz tone. It has to be really pure, so they would generate it with a really high-quality circuit. And of course, this was all tubes back then. And then they would run it through a filter. And I don't think it was only 1 kilohertz, but they would have a filter, a high-quality, low-noise filter, to also more purify it, because obviously if you're measuring distortion, you want your source to have less than 0.001 or whatever you could achieve back in the 1940s. So they would send the 1 kilohertz through the amplifier or whatever was being tested, and that the output, they would run it through a notch filter that removed 1 kilohertz only. So anything that was left, whether it's stuff you knew to measure, it could be noise, it could be harmonic distortion, whatever, something that you don't even know exists. And the reason I call that nulling is because that's the way these notch filters work. A notch filter has a phase shift components, capacitors, not usually inductors, capacitors and resistors. So if you have, if you shift the phase 180 degrees, and at some frequency, and then combine that with this input to this filter, that's what creates the notch, or the complete cancellation. It's not like a program EQ where you set to a really high Q and you go to minus 12 or minus 15 dB. A notch filter is truly completely gets rid of it down to 100 dB, 105 dB, whatever, 90 dB, whatever the capabilities of the circuits. That's why it's called a notch filter. It's not just cutting 10, 12 something dB, and it's very, very narrow. So that works, sort of on nulling, because that's how they create a notch filter, is by shifting the phase at that frequency, 180 degrees, and then combine that with the input, and boom. And that's been around since the 40s. And I make that point when I talk about, nulling and null testing. I say, well, this has been around for a long time. When people say, well, there might be parameters you don't know, this has been around since the 40s. If there was some parameter that real audio, professional audio engineers didn't know about, it would have been revealed, 60 years ago. We would have known about it then, and it would have shown up, and it doesn't.
We actually reached out to you, I think, last year when we were working on another audio myth thing that we were talking about in Live Sound International, which was this idea that phantom power will burn up your ribbon mics. And because right. You talk about it in your book, and you talk about why it's not true, except, there's that one case where you don't want to patch, a ribbon mic to active phantom power through a patch bay, because as the TRS jack is going in, you might get a temporary short. But I think that's very different than the idea that, hey, don't turn on phantom power because you'll melt the ribbon, which is not true. And we looked at the schematics from, I think it was 1938, the RCA Model 44 that you sent us, and we actually reached out to Mike Rivers, who was the technical editor on the first edition of your book, and from there to Wes Dooley from AEA Ribbon Mics, and what we found is, this idea has been around since at least 1938. Probably somebody mispatched that Model 44 mic one time, and probably the ribbon had some existing damage or stress on it, and that may have screwed it up. But by and large, this idea that, hey, keep your phantom power off with ribbon mics is not true, and you're not going to hurt it. And that's another one of those things that, like you said, has just been around for all this time, and it turns out to be based on almost nothing. Do you want to give us one more pervasive audio myth? Well, we've got you.
Well, let me just add, there is one other situation about the ribbon mics. It's not only that if you plug in a quarter inch or a tiny TT thing while the phantom power is on. The original situation, and I didn't even know about this. This actually all came from Mike Rivers while I was working on the first edition of my book. He's the one who told me what the original, I guess it was the 44, they had a center tapped output transformer that was floating. And apparently in some situations, the mic would pick up hum. And they discovered that grounding the center tap fixed the hum. So the microphones, so many microphones, I don't know if they were manufactured that way or if that was a field repair that people would do. But when the center tap is grounded, that also will damage the mic if you give it phantom power. This has nothing to do with patching or a momentary contact, but having the center tap. So you have to then remove the center tap. So I just wanted to say that because I think that was actually the original situation that would cause the ribbon mics to blow up.
So we're talking about a specific limited run manufacturing issue with one model, right? That's then sort of become magnified to, hey, all ribbon mics will blow up if you put your phantom power on.
Exactly, yeah. And I don't own a ribbon mic. I've never cared that much. I have mostly condenser mics in my and when I had a pro studio, we had condensers and dynamics, and I don't think I ever owned a ribbon mic, so that wasn't something I was really knowledgeable about. But that, yeah, as I understand it, that was really the original issue, was that people would ground the center tap as a field repair, or maybe they were made that way later on to get rid of the hum, and that would cause, you know, a problem turning on the phantom power even after it was already connected. So, but I'm sure that doesn't affect, I'm sure none of the ribbon mics that are now making a popularity, I'm sure none of that has anything to do with anything, and I'm sure they aren't susceptible. Just like a dynamic mic. I mean, the transformer in a ribbon mic or the coil in a dynamic mic, those are all floating. They're, you know, encapsulated in plastic and they're not grounded to anything, nor should they be. Otherwise, it wouldn't be balanced XLR, you know, situation for pro audio. So for other myths, well, let's see, there's so many of them out there.
You know what? There's a lot of them that have more relevance to live sound in particular. And I think one of them that I see come up a lot that maybe you can talk about a little bit is the stacking myth.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, yeah, and people believe that if you... And this, I first heard of this with in regard to converters, and I said, "Well, look, you know, you take a cheap, you know, budget sound card or a converter, because they're all pretty good today. You know, the chips are very, very good. The distortion, noise, and frequency response of even a $50 sound card is very, very high quality. So I would say, well, you know, I'm not advocating sound blasters, but I happen to have one because I needed it for something else." And I measured it, and, you know, it's really, really clean. And people say, well, yeah, it's clean on one thing, but if you record a whole bunch of separate things through that sound card, then the little bit of degradation stacks or accumulates, and then it becomes a problem. Of course, that's not true, and I also bust that myth in my audio myths just by showing logically, well, here's what happens when you do that, and you add this, and you add this, and noise adds, signals add coherently, noise adds incoherently, and this rises by 3 dB, So I go through the whole thing and show with graphs and, you know, and pictures and explanations. So that's not true, that if you have something that's colored, if you have a microphone that has a presence peak, and that's a common thing, which, just as a side note, I don't know why a presence peak is important. I mean, I have an equalizer. I'd rather have a flat mic and just tweak it as needed. This singer needs a boost at 4 kilohertz to sound a little, cut through a little better. That one needs 8 kilohertz. That one needs 2. I don't need a presence peak. I'll take a flat mic. But if you have a mic with a presence peak at 6 kilohertz or whatever it is, and you record, you know, 12 tracks, you know, you all separately as overdubs, it's not like you need 12 times more EQ cut to counter that, you know, if you didn't want the boost. It's exactly the same thing. You could sum all those things together, mix them, and then cut that peak. If it was a 4 dB peak, you cut it by 4 dB, and you're back to flat. So the idea of accumulated errors in parallel. Now, in series is something else. You go through, an EQ that boosts 3 dB, and then you go through in series another EQ with 3 – well, now you have 6 dB boost. But in parallel, which is what the stacking stuff is, multiple tracks being overdubbed, this just doesn't happen. And if you think it does, there's your flawed hearing perception or expectation bias or placebo effect or whatever you want to call it.
Well, so we've sort of come full circle back to this is something you can measure and demonstrate and, play that against what you're hearing or what you think you're hearing.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, and added to the willful ignorance and the, you know, and all that other stuff, there's also snobbery. is, you know, as well. I have these converters that cost $2,000 per channel, and they're better than your stupid converters that only cost $100 per channel. So, you know, and there's also what they call buyer's remorse. Well, I just spent $1,000 on this wire, and no way am I ever going to admit even to myself that I was suckered.
Right. It must be better because I spent more money on it. And so, you know, that plays right back into, yeah, I swear it sounds better to me.
Right. Or I can't even admit in public, let alone even to myself, that I was suckered. So there's all these, all these things all come together.
So you're trying to really kind of lift the veil on a lot of this, the deceptive marketing or the, you know, our fallibility and just, you know, sort of bring this stuff into the light and say, hey, if it is better, we can show that. We can measure that. We can prove that.
Right.
And so we can stop debating about whether or not something's better, and we can figure out whether or not it actually is.
And I'm not opposed to good stuff. I have good stuff. I don't buy the cheapest junk. There's also reliability issues, and how nice does something look? You know, there's cheap acoustic treatment that looks like, you know, a company actually sells basically pillow sacks that you stuff insulation into, and they look like hell. But they're cheap, and it's a good solution. If you only have $12 or $20 or whatever they sell these pillow sacks for, then that's fine. So I'm not opposed to nice stuff, but ultimately this was a consumer issue. And, you know, it's consumerism, and I'm a big consumerist. I don't think people should be tricked. I don't like deceptive marketing, and I don't like seeing people waste their money. Some people have a lot of money, and they don't care. It doesn't really matter what they spend. It doesn't hurt them. But a lot of people really do need to get the best value, and if you can get a Focusrite, you know, sound card, you know, stereo sound card for $150, then that's just as good and sounds exactly the same, has no sound of its own, and so it's just as good as a $2,000 card. That gives you more money to buy more microphones or acoustic treatment. And I'm often accused of, well, you sell acoustic treatment, that's why you're telling people don't buy good audio gear, they should spend your money. You know, like, well, no, I was on this kick long before I had a company selling acoustic treatment, and I don't even own that company anymore. So,
well, the other thing is that you've spent a lot of space in your book and on your forum, the Audio Expert forums, helping people do their own acoustic treatment. You know, telling them what materials they can get on their own, and the concepts of where it makes sense to put these things, and understanding modal behavior, and you don't need any commercial bass trapping or any commercial treatment products to do that. And actually, you know, we did that ourselves. I work at a local recording studio, and I helped them do their treatment based largely on the information from your book. And so it's, you know, it's really about you're trying to propagate that knowledge and help people understand, you know, what they need to understand to make their own decisions and whether or not it makes sense for them to buy a commercial product.
Right. Yeah. If you have money, the money to buy it, then it's good. I mean, there are advantages to good commercial acoustic treatment, but you can get, you know, 70, 80, 90% of the way there. Do it yourself. Depends how much effort and you want to put in and how much knowledge you have. But it's certainly cheaper. And I still have on my personal website, ethanweiner.com, I still have the acoustics FAQ, FAQ. That was actually the basis for my book, though my book now has like 10 times more information. But it's a very long, very detailed article explaining all about this and showing how to make bass straps out of rigid fiberglass and what matters. There's other articles on my website. There was one where I compare six-inch thick bass traps to 12 three-inch thick bass traps, the same amount of material, but having 12 traps spread around the room, even though each one is only half as thick, having 12 traps straddling different corners was a lot more effective than having only six, even though each of the six was twice as thick. So that's another article on my site. It's actually part of the density comparison where I compare three different fiberglass densities, because that's another myth, is that, you know, people say this is, you don't need this or you do need that. So there's a lot of stuff on my website that is free, that, you know, has always been there, even after while I owned an acoustics company, because I really believe in this stuff. I really want people to you know, to do well and to get the best benefit. And I love seeing somebody say, wow, I treated my room. I had no idea how much better it could be. I had this bedroom studio and wow, this is like really good.
Yeah. And, you know, the the really quality improvements that can be made with just, you know, a little bit of knowledge that you have on your website, and, you know, minimal budget is really amazing. I mean, just the, you know, the control room of the studio, I've got before and after data, and I think I shared some of that on your forums, actually, you know, and the improvements that we're able to make with just an understanding of the concepts and, you know, very carefully applied budget is amazing. And so anybody that is interested in any of that can go to ethanweiner.com and find links to all the relevant articles. We will also post some information in the description of this podcast. Ethan, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a blast.
Yeah, well, this was fun, and thanks for having me. I love talking about this stuff. I love sharing information, and this is good.
Awesome.
Hey, by the way, I know we've mentioned the website several times, but there's a lot more than just audio and tech and computers there. I encourage everyone to go there and click on the articles page and work down the page, and you will find some really interesting, fun, and highly useful stuff. My own personal favorite is Ethan's article about how to defeat telemarketers and collect cash. That's a great read.
Yes.
So highly recommended.
I just got $1,000 from a company that kept calling me on the phone and spamming me.
It really works.
If you can track them down.
Hey, buddy, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Okay, good. Thanks. That was a lot of fun. I'll talk to you later, guys.
Thanks, Ethan.